I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. From your Amazon orders to that silly cat video you liked, online data is ever-present and valuable. Today, how algorithms turn data into a digital version of you. What's missing from that persona can affect how we experience the internet. So, who controls the creation of our other self, and how is that information being used? Then, when it comes to education reform, it seems like there's always a new plan in the works. A veteran in the field has advice on how to look at improving our education systems and ensuring that all children get the most out of school. After that, the latest in sports with Greg Eklund. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In this digital age, just about all of us have given away information about ourselves. Every time we order through Amazon, we like something on Facebook, or use our cell phones, we leave bits of data behind. In his book, We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves, John Chaney Lippold shows how all those bits create a version of ourselves through the use of algorithms, and the you created as a result is rarely really you. John Chaney Lippold is an assistant professor of American culture and digital studies at the University of Michigan, and he joins us this morning from the studios of WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Every digital action I take leaves data behind. I get that. But what exactly am I leaving behind, John? Let's say I order a movie from Netflix. Now someone knows what kinds of movies I like. I mean, so what?
We can see it in several different degrees, I guess. One of which is, yes, you got that movie, and it is you getting it. But there's other things that are, I think, almost more important to how we can conceive of how our identities operate online. For one, where did you get it? Where did you actually order it? What kind of computer did you use to order it? What was the screen size? What kind of browser did you use? All of those.
You can tell that stuff when I order something online?
They can tell that, even what kind of fonts you have installed, where maybe what kind of language you have predetermined on your computer. And so they take everything, these, you know, hundreds of instances from the single click or from the single order, and they create a profile according to what they think those different bytes and bits mean.
But as I said in the opening, that profile that gets created, sometimes I'm one thing, but what gets created is something completely different.
Yeah, so the fantastically interesting thing, I think, about algorithmic identity, as I talk in the book, is that you're rarely who you think you are. And so I invite your listeners, if they want, to Google, what gender does Google think I am? And they'll maybe be surprised. For example, in the book, I tell how they think Google thinks I'm a 65-year-old woman based on the web queries and based on the sites that I visit through Google.
I wonder what they think about me as a guy who hosts a talk show every day. I'm asking questions on Google all the time about all kinds of things.
But that's the exact
point.
They
think I'm stupid, which probably, you know, might be right. Yeah.
You know, I probably have that too, because I really Google some stupid stuff. But it has to say that they're not really interested in notions of gender, for example, in terms of patriarchy or lived experience, or how, you know, bodies exist in the real world as gendered bodies. More they're interested in, how do I profile somebody in order to sell them a product, a service? How do I tell a news organization like y'all that maybe more women than men are coming to your site or listening to your show? A lot of these things create then a discourse or an idea of knowledge that then is used by, you know, billion-dollar corporations as well as billion-dollar industries in order to make sense of what's happening online.
I was going to say, so bottom line, how complete a representation can our data selves actually be?
It's, in terms of completeness, I'm actually, I wouldn't want to use that word. I'd rather say that we are layered in an immense amount. So there's probably, you know, hundreds of different companies inferring your gender at this moment. There's hundreds of different companies trying to figure out how much money you make in order to sell that data to a company like Orbitz.com in order to tell them, hey, this is a really rich person. They might be able to spend a little bit more money on a hotel or an airplane as they did in 2014.
What is an algorithm exactly? Help me there and dumb this down a lot for me here.
In the most dumbed down way, it is just like a recipe. you know, you need 3 eggs, you need a little bit of salt, you do an order, and what happens is that it is eventually finite. The actual computer science definition is a well-defined set of instructions in order to calculate a function. So the function could be a good omelet. The function could be Google search. The idea, though, is that it's programmed beforehand and it makes sense of everything as data comes in, and then it produces ostensibly new data or new value when it spits out.
John Cheney-Lippold is my guest. His book, We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. You know, this is not just a matter of who is collecting our data, but who is interpreting it as well and how they're interpreting it. An example you offer in the book is U.S. drone strikes. Explain as-if identification to our listeners and what that is.
This is one, I think, one of the most terrifying notions of what algorithmic identity can be, which is that in 2009, President Obama switched from what was then known as a targeted strike, drone strike, to a signature drone strike. The targeted drone strike would be an intelligence agent on the ground knows this person is in this building and I see them. And then a drone locates that building and then it blows it up from, you know, miles up in the air. The problem, though, is, and they're having a little issue kind of identifying people. So they said, what happens if instead of using a person on the ground, we use data? And instead of saying, I know this person is there, we think, well, I know this person looks as if they were a terrorist or as if they were really, you know, somebody we needed to kill in the U.S. sense. And so they would then start creating these weird, interesting maps of ostensibly kind of like as if terrorist identification. So it's not necessarily you know it's a terrorist, but it kind of, if it walks like a terrorist, acts like a terrorist, organizes, for example, groups 35 kilometers outside of city centers of 5 or 10 people, it might be a terrorist. But what happens, and this has happened since 2009, a lot of innocent people have been killed. And so
happening, this as if thing?
Yeah, most definitely. And so a lot of Yemeni wedding parties are actually being bombed because they look much like a terrorist meeting happening 35 kilometers outside a city center, but it's just a bunch of people getting together and having fun.
Man. So explain how patterns of data then are used to determine what is man and what is terrorist.
So the idea that is you can use whatever. You can use what kind of web browser you have. You can use how Orbitz.com use what kind of screen size you use. Google uses search terms and clicks. Other people in research terms have used how you use your mouse, and they try to create a gendered pattern of women use their mouse like this or men use their mouse like that. In terms of terrorism, that's based often in the NSA sense or in the JSOC sense in the Defense Department. It's based often on metadata. And so several people in the upper echelons of government have very famously said, we kill people based on metadata, which just means the phone that you're using, who you're calling, and then the social network map that can be created based on just those instances of who I'm talking to and when.
God, this is just amazing. You point out that our data self is never static, but as you've mentioned here, it's always changing with every data point that we enter. So in a sense, I could be male one day and female the next simply by what I look at on my computer, right, or buy from an online retailer.
Yeah. So, for example, you can conceive of yourself as a gendered body and you carry yourself historically through time. But what happens if you start, you know, maybe if you have a daughter and you're buying products for your daughter, or maybe you're buying products for your wife if you have a wife, that can change day to day. But more important, I think, than even that, the ability for individual profiles to change according to use is that the actual identity of the category itself changes. So, for example, as new terrorist plots come up or as new ideas of what gender is change, that notion of what a data template is that defines terrorist or defines man or defines woman necessarily has to change as well. So in a way, we're existing in this world where even if we know we're a woman or we know we're a terrorist, we don't necessarily know what that means or why we became one.
So who out there is making these decisions? Who's interpreting this data that you're talking about? Who's sitting in the house, the bunker somewhere doing all this?
I think that's a fantastic question because there's two really interesting answers. The first one is it's people like governments and corporations who just want to understand bodies of people or bodies of data in order to make sense of them. For example, the online industry for ads is $83 billion. So it's extraordinary amounts of money, extraordinary amounts of power that can be gleaned from it. Similarly, the idea of the NSA is that it wants to get as much data as possible in order to make very savvy associative kind of inferences based not just on people, but based on populations. Like, what is Egypt doing at the moment, or what is Tunisia doing? So there's this kind of institutional rationality to it, but a lot of times these algorithms are written and then they're made so complex, and the algorithm often recursively updates itself without human intervention, that the agent of inference or the agent of interpretation often baffles the algorithm's authors themselves, because it's not become a sentient being, but it's become a being that follows patterns, and often those patterns don't make any sense to any real-world phenomena.
So someone listening to this, if they're freaked out by what you're saying, you would say what to them?
I would say, I get you're freaking out, but often, and this is the important point that a lot of people have made in terms of privacy, is it's rarely, if ever, a single individual who wants to embarrass you and wants to scarnish your reputation looking at your data. It's most often, 99.999% of the time, an algorithm, and it's just using it in order to give you an ad or to make sense of you in order to tell, you know, NPR station that 65% of your listeners are man or woman, what kind of demographics they have.
What things about an individual, John, you know, cannot be converted to data, or is the belief that everything can be converted to data?
The belief is that everything potentially can be converted to data. I would argue, and in the book I do, that it's really hard to do things like emotion or historical trauma. It's really hard to make that into data. But with the ethos of what we can think of as dataism, which is just bring more and more data, you're going to be able to find out anything, that there are a lot of apps that try to tell you what your mood is. There's a company called Face.com, which several years ago was bought by Facebook, that takes photos and tries to assess what the emotions are of the people in the photo, whether they're smiling or sad. A lot of, there's a company called Mondelez, which owns a bunch of, you know, snacks and stuff, that they have these what are called smart shelves, which they actually assess people as they approach the shelf and try to find out what kind of emotion they are in order to lure them or push them to buy a certain product. Because maybe if they're sad, they're going to like alcohol, or maybe if they're happy, they're going to like chewing gum.
If our listeners have questions for John Cheney Lippold and what all this data means in their lives, 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR.org. You know, is there a margin of error built into these algorithms?
There actually is an institutional, just industry-level error in terms of marketing, which is that often for a profile to be what they call white, which means it's actionable, it has to have a 92% confidence that the data that they're collecting matches the data of the template of what is woman or man. But a lot of companies don't necessarily follow that standard. And even if we look at the NSA, it's an example I bring in the book, which I'm actually very fond of, because in the 2013 PRISM documents that showed the world after Snowden leaked them how the NSA was following our Google accounts and our Yahoo accounts and our Facebook accounts, et cetera, that they were determining who was a citizen and who was a foreigner, not based on what they actually were, because it's very hard and difficult to, you know, understand one's citizenship status based on an online IP address or maybe even what they type. But they created an algorithmic assessment that said that somebody's a foreigner if the NSA is 51% confident that their data suggests they're foreign. And converse to that, if they're 51% confident that somebody's a citizen, the NSA can't surveil them.
You illustrate the control that algorithms can exert. You know, rather than being rigid rules, they can modulate, they can change the rules, as it were, forcing users to adapt. The company behind the popular game World of Warcraft accomplishes this. Explain for our listeners that right now.
I think the most interesting thing that data has brought to us is a sense of granularity, that when we have everything about us, hundreds of things based on a single instance of clicking a button or pushing on your mouse, hundreds of pieces of data that then produce this extraordinarily intimate perspective on what you are, what your desires are, what you might be doing in the future, or also how it can keep your attention. And so World of Warcraft, as a very, very popular game, was able to really fine-tune the notions of how long does it need to be, a quest need to be, or does a game story need to be in order to keep the people's attention, to give them that tension right before they're released and they're given the reward or victory. And so they fine-tune this in such a way that it's a science. And so they hire data scientists in order to tell people exactly how to code certain pieces of software or how to make certain quests in the game. Companies like Uber have used this similar behavioral economics or behavioral statistics in order to figure out how to keep their drivers on the road longer. And it's not necessarily based on, do you want to drive on the road longer? Do you want to continue working? It's to give you those, you know, positive rewards at the right appropriate time to push you towards action.
That's interesting. So where do flaws in algorithms originate then? Where are they?
It can be in several different points. I think the most compelling ways that we see flaws is when we just assume the algorithm is written perfectly, assume that the people actually doing the engineering work are geniuses, because often they are. But there's a computer science slogan called garbage in, garbage out, which means that if you have garbage data and you're trying to make sense of garbage data that is, you know, flawed or maybe wrong or maybe, you know, racist, it's going to produce a racist or flawed or wrong output. So there's this example that I talk in the book, which I'm very fond of as well. It was a 2009 video called HP Computers Are Racist. And what they were doing is there's these two individuals. One was a black guy named Desi. One was a white woman named Wanda. And they were using this HP computer that had facial recognition software in the webcam. The facial recognition software very comically identified the white woman but wouldn't identify the black guy, Desi. So the response by HP was obviously not that, you know, we're a racist company, because he doesn't really believe, when the video makers don't really believe that HP is intentionally being racist, is that they were using data that often probably relied on a bunch of white people instead of people of color, or maybe it relied on, you know, use cases that were based on perfect lighting. And so instead of saying, you know, be a white person, HP said, you just need more front lighting to make yourself, Desi, legible to the camera. But the thing is that this has centuries of history before it. In the 1950s, the Kodak company would have color photos that they would calibrate to white skin, which they called Shirley cards. And so often black actors in Hollywood or even just anywhere would often have to put Vaseline on their face in order to reflect the light at a level that's good for the other white actors.
Yeah. Is it possible to calculate just how much power algorithms have over our lives, John, or is it growing exponentially then?
I would say it's growing, not necessarily exponentially, but it's growing at a rate that we probably don't conceive of. I think the initial example they used at the beginning of ordering Netflix, that's saying so much that we don't necessarily think it says. Because it's saying not just, you know, the time and dates and stuff. It's also, what did you do before? What did you do after? What did you do 10 days after? What did you do 10 minutes later? So all of these things mean nothing. They really don't mean anything. But what happens if there starts to be a pattern that emerges, there starts to be something that is potentially profitable or useful for marketing or for control, that becomes actionable. And whether or not they understand it, whether or not they know what it means, the fact that there's a pattern suggests that they should investigate it further. So flaws won't be necessarily, you know, this was entirely wrong, but flaws will be fixed in the idea of this kind of reiterative process of using more data and more data and more data, because ostensibly a single flaw will then be fixed by, you know, better data and better algorithms.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Patrick from Kansas City, Kansas. Patrick, good morning. Go ahead, Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
I thought it was interesting that the Kansas, that the police departments are using cell phones to track people where they are. For instance, I was not allowed to vote because I was in California for a period of time. They confronted me with that.
John?
Wow. That is new to me that they would actually use that data as a prefiguring of your right to vote. The cases I'm more familiar with are cases like the Chicago Police Department that use predictive policing to try to figure and use data in order to make sense of, you know, where to put resources or where to, you know, where to pay attention in terms of police officers. The Chicago Police Department took that a degree further, which might be more in line with the experience of the caller, which is that they figured out that people who are, quote, socially connected to people who are either victims or assailants of violent crimes were at risk of being a victim or an assailant of a violent crime. And so often the Chicago Police Department would take people based only on their data, knock on their door, and tell them that they're being watched. this very dystopian notion is just, I think, the logic of if we have data, this person is maybe going to be guilty, maybe going to be innocent, but it's likely percentage-wise through their data that they're going to commit a crime or be a victim of a crime, so the police should watch them even further. The eventual logic that this gets to is a case that just happened a couple weeks ago in Wisconsin when the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, ruled that a judge could use a algorithm by a company. The algorithm is called Compass, and it's a recidivism algorithm, but they used it for sentencing. And because the algorithm said that this one person was likely to be a recidivist, was likely to commit a crime again, based on data that has nothing to do necessarily with crime, but has something to do with what kind of gender the person is, what kind of zip code they were born in, even what their proclivities are, like, you know, do they think it's okay for somebody to steal? The person eventually was given 6 years in prison, in part because the algorithm said that this person was going to commit a crime again. This also, this same algorithm, Compass, has last year was at the center of an investigative journalism report by ProPublica that more or less showed that, much like the HP computers is racist example, that the data that the Compass program uses often is racist and makes black people much more likely in terms of the algorithm to be recidivists than white people, which is not necessarily the case.
I mean, that's just scary. I mean, if those kinds of decisions are being made based on data, which, you know, as you're saying here today, may or may not be all that accurate.
Yeah, and the more kind of mind-boggling part even further than that is that in the case that the Supreme Court decided, the defendant, his name's Loomis, he was suing the state saying, I have no access to this algorithm. It's a proprietary algorithm. It's entirely black boxed and closed to me. And not only do I not have access to it, but the algorithm also changes as they make new updates to it. So what might have gotten somebody 6 years in 2015 might give them 7 years in 2016, might give them 3 years in 2018. So the notion of we actually know how we're being treated, it's kind of very Kafkaesque. Like, we often don't know how we're being treated or how we're being understood, but we're nonetheless influenced by those interpretations of who we are.
Tell us about the use algorithmy, which is just fascinating to me. It looks at things like what, if I'm actually located in the U.S. or not, and
yeah.
What else?
So this is what I referenced earlier about the kind of idea of 51% citizenship or 51% foreignness. Use algorithmy is a notion that is trying to think through what is the way or how does the state of the U.S. understand a citizen or foreigner if there's no necessarily kind of identifying information, such as a passport or the birth certificate. Because, again, you don't go on Facebook and say, here's my proof of citizenship, nor do you go on Google and do the same thing. So rather, they use data points, like you said, like, is your IP pulling from inside the U.S.? Do you talk to people inside the U.S.? Do you use English as a language? Do you use encryption or do you not use encryption? And so if you, for example, have relatives or friends in Italy and you speak Italian to them and maybe you went to visit them once, that data is seen to be foreign and it's likely that you'd be interpreted as a foreigner, but you're still a U.S. citizen in the real world, but algorithmically you're seen to be a foreigner. And because of that, the NSA has legal authority to surveil you until your data proves otherwise.
So ultimately, then, how cautious should we be about engaging digitally? I mean, should we be concerned about finding ways to present a truer picture of ourselves through the data that we're utilizing?
I think that's exactly the question we need to ask. I'm a proponent of assuming that, much like I want to have complete participation in how I'm understood by my friends or family, that I don't want them just to talk about me and make decisions based on, you know, a one-sided argument, that I want to have an ability to talk back to these algorithms. And precisely because they're not really interested in understanding me for me, they're interested in understanding me to sell me or to control me.
Right.
I'm a proponent of what is called obfuscation, which is a practice that says that because these surveillance systems are mostly they're requiring some sort of pattern to emerge from your data, that there's going to be a signal that comes from the noise. So obfuscation is a strategy that says, let's say you search for a bunch of soccer sites. They're going to know that you're a soccer fan. But if you have, every time you search for a soccer site, you automatically, through a plugin called TrackMeNot, send 6 or 7 different rogue random.
Are you there? I think we've lost him. Maybe was he cut off at the end of the segment there? We'll try and see if we can't get John back on the line. John Cheney Lippold, he's the author of We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll either continue our conversation with John or we'll turn to education reform and what you need to know. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, the ethics professors discuss involuntary deboarding, who should make end-of-life decisions for minors, and whether President Trump's advisors owe him their loyalty. You can find those conclusions and their conclusions at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, I'll speak with guitarist John Scofield, who's performing at the KC Jazz and Heritage Festival this weekend, and we'll revisit battle sites of World War I, 100 years after America entered the conflict. Well, education reform in this country has a history that goes back at least to the early 1800s. It makes you wonder why it's been and remains such a major issue in America. Perhaps our next guest can provide an answer. Frederick Hess is Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. Hess has pursued the subject of education reform since his doctoral dissertation at Harvard. His latest book is Letters to a Young Education Reformer, and he joins me now. And Rick, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Hey, pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, you write in this book, to me, reform is mostly a matter of opening up an outdated system so that educators, entrepreneurs, parents, and communities can reinvent schooling to better educate every child. How do you know when a system is outdated to begin with?
You know, there's no simple answer to that. But look, let's think about teaching, for instance. We've got a teaching workforce, which looks like it does, because we had 90% of teachers in the early 1800s were men. And when Horace Mann wanted to build out the common schools in Massachusetts, he needed cheap labor and plentiful labor. So they feminized the teaching profession. But they didn't trust women to make these judgment calls. They put men in charge. Over the years, we built salary schedules that assumed teachers couldn't do anything else, wouldn't do anything else. We assumed people would work for 30 years in the same job. This all worked gangbusters in 1955. Mm-hmm. It's not that these were bad ideas. It's that they aren't actually the way Americans go and find jobs today. They're not the way we compete for talented folks. We're not the way we recognize people who are doing well. So to me, it's not that there's any kind of fact-based test that proves schools are outdated. It's that when one thinks about why schools look the way they do and what we're asking educators to do with kids, it seems to me the way they're set up doesn't get us where we want to go today.
You know, is reform the right word to use here? Because it can be taken as saying there's something wrong or corrupt with the work that teachers are doing these days.
And it's spot on. When you listen to, you listen to the speeches on this stuff, we often talk about American schools are failing or teachers are failing, which is, I'm not actually sure what that means. Look, our schools are, we're not seeing the results for so many of our children we'd like to see. I think that's partly because families and home environments aren't setting them up to succeed as much as we would like. It's partly because our schools can and should do better. But reform, you're right, has this connotation of they're doing something wrong and we're going to fix them. For me, the better way to think about it is that what we want to do is look at the things that we all want schools and teachers to do for our kids, and how do we empower educators, and how do we equip schools to do more of the things that we want them to do.
It seems like no sooner are educators handed one set of policies than another set comes at them. How are they supposed to keep up? Because everyone's got ideas how to reform schools, and everything's changing every year.
It's crazy. And like one of the responses to the two things we just touched on, the sense that we want our schools to do better and that schools maybe aren't designed to work for all of our kids in 2017, is we just rain one reform after another on schools. You mentioned my Harvard dissertation I did back in the 90s. It was my first book, came out in 1998. I pointed out at the time that when you looked at 57 big American school systems, they launched an average of a major reform every 3 months. The only thing you do, if you're a teacher in that building is you close your door and you tell your neighbor, this too shall pass. If we want reform to actually work for kids, it requires patience, it requires persistence, it requires things that are in short supply when it comes to school reform.
I was going to say, do we tend to give these ideas enough time to actually take root and see if they work or not?
No, absolutely. Partly, we tend to forget, because I think it's inconvenient. One of the nice things about education reform is everybody means well. We're all, in some sense, on the same team, which is not true of so much of what we argue about. Problem is, because we mean well, we forget how schools actually work. Great schools tend to have a couple basic things in common. They tend to have a clear sense of mission, a coherence to the culture. Teachers tend to feel responsible for doing their job, but also empowered to put a hand on a kid's shoulder or give a kid a kick in the pants. And parents in those schools tend to feel like the schools reflect and respect the things they care about. They're on the same page. And what happens when you rein reform on schools is you dissolve those cultures, teachers start to feel disempowered, and parents feel like they don't know what's going on. And what happens is rather than saying, gosh, maybe reform is part of the problem, we say, well, we must need another reform. We need a new superintendent who's going to come in with a new three-point plan. And so in some sense, you know how physicians worry about overprescribing antibiotics because we create these drug-resistant super flus? In some ways, I worry we've created reform-resistant schools where each of these ideas rains down so fast that we create such frustration among the educators that nothing is actually going to pay off.
So if you do want to change the way kids are taught in a school, how do you go about doing it the right way, Rick?
Well, I think one, you know, we've got to understand a new superintendent or state leader will come in and say, look, this time we mean it. We know there's been a lot of craziness and they mean it. But what's funny is the teachers that superintendent is talking to have heard the same speech four times. And so there's a huge amount of skepticism.
Yeah.
So one, you've got to really find ways to break through that skepticism. That requires continuity. It requires outreach. The other thing, though, is I'm a guy who thinks school choice has an important role to play in school improvement. Not because it's any kind of fix, but because one of the powerful things I think about school choice is it makes it easier for educators, for communities to launch new schools, charter schools or whatever else. And those schools start with a clean slate. They attract teachers who buy into the mission, families who want to be there. One of the things it does is it gives you a chance to escape so much of the baggage that you've got to fight against in schools that are already struggling.
Rick Hess will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. It's an event sponsored by the library and the Show Me Institute. More information on the library's website. You differentiate, Rick, between reform with a big R and reform with a little R. What's big R reform?
You know, big R reform is all the stuff that's got capital, we talk about in capital letters, proper nouns. So Common Core, Race to the Top, No Child Left Behind. The small high school initiative, comprehensive school reform. It's not that these first off, the people pushing these things mean really well.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I honestly think that most of these reflect pretty reasonable ideas.
Mm-hmm.
No Child Left Behind started with the notion that it's not okay to turn our back on some of the kids who are coming into our schools. I agree. Common Core started from the notion that we need to set high standards and have comparable tests. I agree. The problem with big R reform is that folks get so caught up in these big national solutions that they lose sight of how this plays out in real communities for real kids and in real schools. And little R reform doesn't say that we shouldn't try to do these big, important changes. It says that what matters much more than whether we have a big initiative is how we actually run with it.
You know, as you said, you're a self-declared little R reformer saying that those making decisions should be responsible for making them work and also for the consequences. But that's, you know, oftentimes not how it's being done, right? I mean, federal and state governments are making decisions, then they leave it up to the school districts and educators to bear the responsibility, oftentimes without enough money. How do we correct all that?
You know, honestly, and that's partly the way our system works. If you're a governor, you've got a four-year term. And people are looking to you. They're saying, gosh, do something for these kids. So it's, you know, one of the things when you listen to kind of the high-profile school reform wars is we tend to talk about the good guys and the bad guys. And whichever side you're on is the good guys and the other guys. And I've been doing this stuff for close to 30 years now, and I have found hardly anybody who's actually a bad guy when you sit down and talk to them for half an hour. That most people are doing what they think is going to be good for kids, but they're in a hurry to do it. And the challenge here is that because so many people mean well, and because there's such a sense of urgency about doing well by kids, that we say, well, we've got to jam this into I think the big corrective here is honestly good judgment. It's common sense. It's experience and wisdom. It's saying, look, we know that we mean well, but honestly, if we go ahead and try to evaluate teachers with this crazy ginned up new system we're talking about, we're not going 5 years out to look back and say, hey, we've got a more professional teaching force. We're going to have frustrated teachers, created backlash, and had people say, well, that was a dumb idea. So partly what we've tended to do is race forward and then say, we hope that worked. And I think the way to correct for this is to spend a lot more time measuring twice and cutting once.
You know, one of the letters in this book explains talkers and doers. Each has a role in education reform, you say, and can work in concert. Explain what each does and how they can work together, Rick.
Yeah, and it's a familiar concept. You know, I say, look, talkers are people like me, people who work at think tanks and universities and state capitals. And we get, and doers are the people who actually educate kids, people in schools and classrooms. You can make the same distinction about policing or anything else. And the people who really we want driving the train are the people who do the work, because they're the ones who see how this stuff plays out on the ground for real kids day to day. Problem is, and it's a real issue, is that people who do the work also have big blind spots. When you're in that same school 190 days a year, that's all you know. You tend to think all schools are like your school. You get myopic. When people say critical things about schools, it tends to be very personal. This is you and your friends. So talkers have a role to play. We can offer perspective. We can offer comparisons. We have the freedom to come up with stuff because we don't have to do the work. Problem is, in this age of kind of professionalized reform, it's easy for reformers to get too impressed with ourselves because we get to be on radio and give speeches and write books. And instead of recognizing that we're only there to work in tandem with doers, it's we've seen way too many reformers start to think that the reformers are really where the action is, and doers are just the people who are getting in the way.
How much cooperation are you seeing between the two groups these days?
Remarkably little. I mean, you hear when you'll hear and you'll read about the war on teachers, and I think that's how big this divide is between the talkers and doers. The reality is, people are trying. There are lots, I think, of superintendents who've recognized this. I think Mark Bedell in Kansas City has talked about he's got a teacher advisory that he works with on these issues. I think you see that in a lot of places. You've got a Teach to Lead initiative at the U.S. Department of Education created just to address this. So I think folks are aware of it, but it's a real challenge.
You know, before a reform sweeps the nation, shouldn't those pushing it forward be able to prove it'll actually work? I mean, test it thoroughly, present the results, all those things that sort of make common sense?
You would think.
But it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. I mean, and there's a good reason it doesn't happen and a bad reason it doesn't happen. The bad reason it doesn't happen is because people get into education. It's funny, when you hear people talk about, say, healthcare, or people say, look, everyone needs better health, but they tend to talk about how do we help deal with costs or how do we help. You don't hear them say, how do we make sure all Americans have good lives?
Mm-hmm.
Education, though, has this amazing promise. People get an education because they want it to be a more just world, economic opportunity for every child. And so they don't have a lot of patience for the ins and outs of teaching and learning. And there's a sense of urgency and there's a sense of doing good. So they say, we've got an idea. Let's do it everywhere now. The good reason, the more understandable reason, why we don't have that kind of evidence is, look, frankly, a lot of the stuff that we talk about as school reform, it's hard to know what evidence would prove that it works. When you're talking That's about something like teacher evaluation or school choice, you can go back for decades in the Harvard Business Review, and nobody has ever proved that it's better to pay good employees more than bad employees. These are just kind of common sense intuitions. But what we want to do is Common Core, for instance, I talk about in the book. There are about 15 states that were dying to run with it back in 2009. The Obama administration should have not encouraged anybody else to do it, should have said, you 15, you go try it. Let's study what happens. Let's see the results. If you guys really are seeing good things happen for your kids, I have enough faith in this country that I think other states would have wanted to jump on board. But what happens is, out of the best of intentions, folks sometimes wind up short-circuiting that natural process.
Would you take the federal government out of this mandated 50-state education reform business altogether?
Mostly, yeah. I think the federal government has a couple of useful roles to play when it comes to schooling. I'm a small government guy in general, which I think but I think in education in particular, what folks need to appreciate is, if we were France or Cuba and Washington ran schools, it would be a different conversation. But in the U.S., what happens is Congress writes a law. The folks at the U.S. Department of Education spend 18 months writing regulations, which get explained to state education agency officials in Missouri, who then have to do trainings for district Title I court. By the time it makes it down to principals and teachers, there's a crazy game of telephone that has turned it into a checkbox kind of enervating exercise for everybody. So what I want to see Washington do is be in the business of making sure we have good and comparable data so that voters and parents have some way to compare how their kids are doing. I want to see Washington in the business of funding research, because research is a public good, which tends to be underinvested in by states and localities. And I want to see Washington in the business of making sure that folks in states and communities aren't trapped by yesterday's decision. This is what we usually think of as bankruptcy provisions, that just because you wrote a terrible vendor agreement in 1983, there ought to be a mechanism for getting out of it if it's no longer working for kids in the community.
But maybe the problem is politics. People want to run for office on these common sense ideas to improve education, and you simply can't stop it.
You know, in the 1980s, education was never in the top 10 or 12 issues that people looked for a president when they said, what are you worried about? Today, it's consistently in the top 4 or 5. And so folks running for national office feel like they have to take a stance, and they got to push to do something. Yeah. And then we're off to the races.
Frederick Hess is his formal name. His latest book is Letters to a Young Education Reformer. Again, you can see and hear him tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, an event sponsored by the library and the Show Me Institute. His the title of his talk, Advice to Young and Old Education Reformers. Rick, great to have you here. Great information. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, thanks. My pleasure.
Greg Eklund covers sports for KCUR, and he's taking a break from the road today to talk not about the pros, but the college sports scene. Greg, always good to have you here. Thanks
good
for coming
morning,
in.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
We're looking at the college sports scene in KC, which means mostly KU Jayhawks and Mizzou Tigers. Now, even though Mizzou has a strong alumni base in Kansas City, Tiger sports have been losing relevance in this area since their move to the SEC, 5 years ago?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because you're right. You don't sense it as much.
The signature programs have slipped, quite frankly.
Football and basketball.
Absolutely. Since Coach Pinkel stepped down at Mizzou with the football program under Barry Odom, it has slipped. I mean, Mizzou football got off to a great start in the SEC in the final years of the Pinkel era.
Which no one expected, by the way.
Right. Not even the SEC folks expected that. They thought that, if anything, that MU was going to make a dent in basketball, and it has been the opposite. Now both of them have been slipping the last couple years, and because of that, MU relevance in Kansas City has slipped, and the MU fan base, as you mentioned, Steve, is very strong here, and the Tiger fans have been craving for some Kansas City relevance with the Missouri Tiger football or basketball program, but it looks like it's going to happen in basketball.
I was going to say, Kansas City relevance, are there signs there's going to be some of that, or where are we there?
I think this upcoming season in basketball, it is very possible, mainly because of the timing and the hiring of Konzo Martin, the new basketball coach. Let's face
it. He's completely lit up the whole scene over there.
It really has, especially when he landed Michael Porter Jr., arguably
remind everybody who he is.
The top recruit in the country, who started his high school career right there in Columbia. His father was an assistant coach for the women's basketball team at MU, and then he was hired away as an assistant at the University of Washington, which is where Michael Porter Jr. had originally committed to. Here comes the timing part. Washington fires their head coach, Lorenzo Romar. They also fire the assistant coach, Michael Porter Sr. So they're basically free agents again, so to speak. And not only is Michael Porter Jr. committed to go to Mizzou, but Michael Porter Sr. is going to be an assistant coach at Mizzou.
Which is what happened with a certain player named Danny Manning once upon a time.
It is a common practice. Danny Manning was the player. Ed Manning was an assistant coach. More recently, Mario Chalmers was the standout guard who made the big shot in the championship game in 2008. And Ronnie Chalmers was the director of operations at that's a KU at KU for the basketball program.
So basically what you're saying here is if Mizzou starts winning again, Kansas City might start paying attention again.
Exactly. Like I say, the MU fans have been craving for it, but let's face it, this is Big 12 country. The SEC has no postseason championships here. The SEC really hasn't caught on to Kansas City as much as it has caught on the eastern side of the state in the St. Louis market. And part of it is because of the slippage of the two signature teams at MU.
Why wasn't MU able to succeed under Kim Anderson, the former basketball coach?
It comes down to players. He was not able to recruit. When you lose the guy that's in your backyard, that doesn't sit well. And not only when Michael Porter switched his commitment from Washington to Missouri help the Mizzou program right off the bat, but he brings some of his friends. And there's a guy out of East St. Louis named Jeremiah Tillman, who's from East St. Louis, which is where Konzo Martin came from, and he has committed to Missouri. So all of a sudden now you have a top 10 ranked recruiting class coming to Mizzou. Kim Anderson was never able to bring in that top-notch talent, and what little talent he had, they didn't stay. They transferred out.
So Michael Porter has some help coming with him,
He does. He is bringing some of his buddies with him, and Mizzou with some young talent, but they are very talented coming in for the next basketball season.
You know, something else that's been missing here has been this border war basketball game, MU-KU sort of slugging it out. Some fans still clamoring for its revival. Any chance we'll see a KU-MU basketball game in the foreseeable future? Because I'm not hearing any talk about
it. Yeah, I don't think it's foreseeable.
Who doesn't want it? Which side is it?
It's KU that doesn't want
Why?
It. Which to me is hypocritical because KU, you know, ever since MU left the Big 12 to go to the SEC, they vowed they would not play MU. Well, it has happened in other sports where in softball, for example, they've met on the field in the NCAA tournament. But what makes it hypocritical from the KU standpoint is that KU has gone out and played two other schools that have left the Big 12. They play Colorado in basketball. They play Nebraska in basketball. Why can't the Jayhawks play Missouri? It would be and create great fan interest. I would love to see it, but I don't think it's foreseeable.
If Bill Self was sitting here, what do you think he'd say about this?
He'd say the same reason he would give as to why they don't play Wichita State. They have more to lose and nothing to gain. But when KU lost to Wichita State a couple of years ago in the NCAA tournament, KU didn't slip that much. They were right back on top.
We've talked about MU's recruiting and how good it was this offseason. What about KU's recruiting on that front, Greg?
Interesting twist on the KU offseason. They've had some people transfer out. You have the expected pro announcement from Josh Jackson, who will be drafted in the upcoming NBA draft.
Top four or five picks, right?
He'll be up there. But their incoming players are more in the form of transfers than they are of incoming freshmen. They had a guy transfer back in January from Arizona State. They've got a pair of brothers coming in from Memphis. They'll have to sit out the upcoming season because of transfer rules, but they're coming in as newcomers.
Sort of like the Morris twins coming in here.
Sure. And then they have a guy who's a graduate transfer. He already got his degree from William & Mary. He stands 6'9". He's going to give them frontline strength. His name is Jack Whitman. He'll be a graduate transfer. And then more recently, the announcement of Dwight Colby transferring out came to the forefront, but again, that's not a surprise either. He's 6'9", but he had a knee injury and played in limited action last season for the Jayhawks.
So KU's recruiting class sounds like it's been pretty good.
Let's put it this way. They're more experienced because of the transfer, and they do have a lot of players coming back, so there won't be much of a fall-off from KU's standpoint.
Greg Eklund covers sports for KCUR. Greg, always good to have you here. Thanks for the update.
Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate it. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, jazz guitarist John Scofield used to play with Miles Davis. And we go back over there to France for the stories remembered in World War I cemeteries, monuments, mines, and trenches as well. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.